From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, your life in color, auras, and all those great things. Well, we're back from Toronto at the Toronto Health Show. Had a great time this weekend. People loved it. The place was packed. Doc Wallach was there from criticalhealthnews.com. Same with pharmacist Ben Fuchs and so many others. Ty Bollinger, Cancer Step Outside the Box. People in Canada really are concerned about health, and boy, do they know American politics. Wow. Totally incredible. And most of them in the crowd said, we love Donald Trump. It was something else. On the way back to St. Louis, the worst plane flight of my life. Turbulence for the last hour. I thought the plane was going down. I mean, it was unbelievable. There was a lady who worked for Boeing sitting in the seat next to me. It was a small plane, two seats, aisle, two seats. And she grabs onto my arm, petrified, and she's used to flying. It was the worst flight I've ever had in my life. Just unbelievable. And back in St. Louis, what a treat tonight. I had a chance to meet Mike Love from the Beach Boys, one of the original Beach Boys. He was celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary. And, you know, Mike and the Beach Boys were discovered by Russ Regan, a friend of us. And Russ has been battling some health issues. But I put the two of them together tonight, and that was kind of cool. Russ lives in Los Angeles. Well, the Beach Boys were called the Pendletons because they wore these Pendleton shirts a long time ago, and Russ heard the name and said, nah, we're calling you the Beach Boys, and that's how that changed. Russ also found Neil Diamond and discovered Elton John. And then talking about Elton John, almost lost him. Elton John was left in intensive care. He has finally left after being struck down by a potentially deadly bacterial infection in South America. Now, the 70-year-old star fell violently ill on a flight back to Britain from Santiago, Chile, and received emergency treatment in a hospital in the United Kingdom. Doctors worked very fast to remove the infection, and John is believed to have stayed in the hospital for 12 days, two of which were in intensive care before being released. So prayers for Elton John. President Donald Trump talked to leaders of both China and Japan as tensions on the Korean Peninsula have boiled over and North Korea appears ready for another ICBM launch. Mr. Trump spoke by phone with the Chinese president and Japanese prime minister. Japan's military claimed it sent destroyers to join the Carl Vinson carrier group on its way to North Korea's doorstep, and South Korea was in talks to take part as well. Well, in China, Alibaba, which is the equivalent of our Amazon.com, their chairman there said that the society should prepare for decades of pain as the internet disrupts the economy. The world must change, he says, because the internet is going to do all kinds of things to the economy. Well, it already has, but bricks and mortar stores, retail establishments are getting hit and hit hard by the internet. As a matter of fact, just a few days ago, the BB store chain, the woman's store chain, announced they are closing all their stores in the United States. Let's check in with the expert on the internet, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, it's coming, and it's coming fast, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming. I was thinking about this today, and I was trying to think of a way to put this into a historical context, because in a way, this is a continuing story, and I think I found a way to do this. You'll recall the Meredith Wilson's great classic musical, The Music Man, of course.
Yes.
The film version of that came out in 1962. The story takes place in 1912. At the beginning of that film, the traveling salesmen are riding in the train on their way to River City, and they're bemoaning the changes that are occurring in their business. They talk about the Model T Ford. People don't want to shop in the little stores anymore. They want to go to the big city. Who's going to patronize a little bitty 2x4 kind of store anymore, right? What do you talk?
Yep.
Harold Hill is ordering his instruments by mail order. Sears Roebuck was already starting to change the face of commerce at that point. People mm-hmm. were ordering from the catalog.
Their catalog, that's right.
All of that. So as this all occurred, the old commerce methods, the pickle barrel stores, all of these things that people thought were the whole of commerce evolved and changed, and if they couldn't change, they died off. That's what we're seeing now. It's really the continuation of that. Sears, of course, is now in trouble because they couldn't move into the online.
Oh, they are. JCPenney's in trouble. They're all in trouble.
They couldn't move into the online side of this fast enough while innovators like Amazon or Alibaba figured out ways to do it.
That's right.
So it's like any other form of evolution, right? It's adapt or die. So if the traditional brick and mortar chains want to be able to survive in this kind of environment, they can do it, but it requires a hybrid approach. I mean, it means they need to be able to find a way to tie together online commerce, web commerce with their stores. There's been a lot of success in some quarters with having people order online and pick up, right, or order online and return to the physical stores. But if you just try to stick with the old models, you're going to be dead as a dodo.
So what happens if the Internet goes down for any length of time and all these retail stores have been closed? What are people going to do then?
Well, of course, it's gotten to the point now where if a major site goes down for like 10 minutes, it becomes headline news, right, around the world. Amazon goes down for 5 minutes, there's panic in the streets, right?
Well, it pulled down part of the Internet a couple months ago.
So it's not as if, you know, large chunks are going to go down for any period of time, but you make a very good point because so many of these stores have become so dependent on this. And they don't have backup plans in a lot of cases. That's key. You have to have backup plans. You have to have ways to move your electronic commerce servers to other parts of the network, for example. That if you're down for an hour, it can be tens of millions of dollars of lost sales.
Exactly. You know, this weekend when I was in Toronto at the health show, Lauren, I was with pharmacist Ben Fuchs, and he was telling me how Amazon has a digital button. It's a button, like you put it, if you need more dish detergent,
right.
You hit the button and they order it and send it to you.
Yeah, they've been promoting that. It turned out that button had kind of a downside.
Well, it costs money for the button, doesn't
it? Not just that, there's something else, which is it doesn't have any inherent authentication. So what happened is they were finding the buttons were at child level.
The kid kept hitting the button.
Yeah, they just go on.
I love it.
Push, and then all of a sudden, 12 tons of detergent shows up. You know,
I love it.
Speaking, but really, people were having problems with children who were doing ordering by pushing those buttons. So that indicated that technology has a ways to develop. Also,
keep watching the internet for us, Lauren. Keep watching. A woman trying to rescue her own dogs from a raging creek in Utah ended up drowning. Police say the 58-year-old victim of Salt Lake City and her husband were walking their dogs at the time. The dogs got into the water and they got caught up in a current, and she went to rescue the dogs. She got caught up in the current and drowned. The dogs are okay.
Sunday, Monday.
Aaron Moran likely died of complications of stage 4 cancer, according to an autopsy. The star of Happy Days played the part of Joni Cunningham, dead at the age of 56, found in her apartment, dead of cancer. A dark filament of magnetism on the sun exploded. A new analysis shows that debris from the explosion will not hit planet Earth. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky.
Hi, George. So many wonderful things happening. Many people caught this today. President Trump, of course, congratulating astronaut Dr. Peggy Whitson on board the International Space Station. Her record, more than any American for time in space, 534 days in space. She's the oldest woman in space. And also, at 57 years of age, she was the first woman to command an expedition, as they call it, on the ISS, and the first woman to do it twice. Get a load of this. She'll be coming back in September. And by that time, she'll have well over 650 days in space, beating Scott Kelly's old record by a lot of 520 days. And, George, a lot of people wonder, who has the most time in space? Well, it's a Russian cosmonaut, I should say, Colonel Gennady Padalka. He spent some 879 days in space. Imagine that. And he's going to go back for more in September of 2018 to maybe surpass 1,000 days in space. I'd like to see what happens to his body. But in conclusion, in the live sky, George, great things for the listening audience to see. If you're up early in the early morning hours, those eyes are peeled to the skies. You'll see a beautiful waning crescent moon. hugging the horizon. And at this time, the planet Venus is literally at its brightest in the morning sky. And you know, George, so many people report that as simply as an unidentified flying object. But we on coast know better. Always simply remember this. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. Really appreciate it. Up next, we're going to talk about earthquake prediction. David Nabhan joins us. Wait till you hear this story. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Each year, the world faces thousands of earthquakes of a 5 or greater magnitude, resulting in devastating property destruction and tragic loss of life. Now, to help avert these catastrophes, scientists have long searched for ways to predict when and where the earthquakes will happen. Tonight, David Nabhan joins us. His latest book is called Earthquake Prediction, Dawn of the New Seismology. David was with me, almost 5-6 years ago. David, welcome back to the program.
Hey, George, thanks for having me back on again. I appreciate the invitation. It's a real privilege to talk with you and your listeners. I'm much obliged.
I got to tell you, too, the timing for this, absolutely incredible, because everybody's talking about the big one on the West Coast these days, David. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you're right. Every seismologist on the planet realizes that that's in the near horizon. In the early 80s, the Working Group on California Earthquake Probabilities issued their findings when the next big one might strike, and that's decades ago. They gave it a 50% chance between then and 2018. Well, 2018 is upon us. We've lo and behold, that's next year. So there's no seismologist on the planet who isn't of the opinion that the big one for Los Angeles isn't. You know, we're all going to see that in the very near future. In my opinion, it's not decades away. It's not years away. It's months away. You know, 10 months, 30 months, 60 months. It could very well happen tomorrow.
Okay, so earthquake prediction, dawn of the new seismology. What does that mean, new seismology?
Well, yeah, seismology has, very simply, has put the interest of the 50 million Americans living on the West Coast above a peculiar mantra that became ingrained in our culture a century ago. This earthquake prediction is impossible refrain that it's dominated the topic of seismicity in the United States for decades. But it's not 1917; it's 2017, and the world has changed in so many ways. I mean, your listeners should just think about that for a moment. You know, hearts, lungs, livers transplanted now, and our vessels piercing the heliopause on their way into interstellar space. We've cataloged the 3 billion base pairs of the human genome. But we're yet supposed to accept the fact that scientists who know what was happening 14 billion years ago in the first few trillionth of the second after the Big Bang are nonetheless clueless, and clueless forever, I guess, in perpetuity, about what's happening here and now on the West Coast beneath their very feet. It's an absurdity on its face, and one doesn't need to be a great genius or a seismologist or a scientist to understand that. What's being postulated here is somebody somewhere somehow trying to prove a negative, and that seismic forecasting for some strange reasons shall forever remain in the realm of impossibility. So your listeners should ask themselves that a very cogent question about that, and that's, how this happened. Who is the genius that first stood up from and proclaimed that? Who's the guy from Humanity's Scientific Hall of Fame that came forth with that tautology for? It wasn't Isaac Newton or Bertrand Russell or any Albert Einstein. No great scientist has ever said that. It's just been repeated and repeated and repeated so often from so long ago that it's been locked into the public consciousness.
Well, when they talk about new seismology, what is wrong, David, with the old seismology?
Well, like I said, everything has changed. You can pinpoint the exact moment. 1755 in Lisbon, that great cataclysm, the Lisbon earthquake, took place in a different era from everything that happened before. It was the Age of Enlightenment, and it shook Europe like people don't realize that. Kant, Rousseau, Voltaire, and all the great minds, they took that matter up for months. Everybody wondered what power could have the colossal muscle to pick up a great city and turn it upside down. And, this is 200 years ago before fusion and fission, so there was really only one place to look, up. And lunar and solar gravitational tides are tremendously powerful forces. Every day we see them at work in our own planet, moving the seas around as if, you know, no great weight at all, like sloshing the water around like water in a baby's bassinet. I can't give you the long list of eminent scholars who have published studies indicating that gravitational tides have had a hand in triggering earthquakes. Not making earthquakes, not, you know, causing them, but triggering them, being the last straw on the camel's back about on earthquakes that are about to explode in any event. There are hundreds of these studies published everywhere from the 1800s to the present, and the idea is so old that the first one I found should have been delivered to the governor of California, but it couldn't have been because it would have had to have been in Spanish because California belonged to Mexico in those days.
That's right.
It was, 1845, Richard Edmonds on the remarkable lunar periodicities and earthquakes. So, but after him, Alexis Perry in the 1870s, Charles Davison in the 1880s, UCLA's Leon Konopoff and Elizabeth Cochran in the 1960s and 2000s. So, and only recently, a few months ago, a watershed study was published in the Nature Geoscience that caused screaming headlines all over the world. The LA Times ran articles entitled "Big Tides Can Trigger Large Earthquakes," "Quakes on San Andreas Triggered by Gravitational Tides," and the LA Times is a very conservative newspaper when it comes to this matter. The Washington Post chimed in. There, I'm reading the title here, "Major Quakes Might Be Caused by the Moon." This was just months ago. In every newspaper on the planet, from the Anchorage Dispatch to the Zurich Zeitung. So no one ever asked the earthquake prediction is impossible crowd for comments when these studies come out over and over again, year after year, decade after decade. And as your listeners, George, should be well apprised, and they'll find out in my book, gravitational tides are certainly not the only game in town. Quite to the contrary, they're far, far down the list compared to what science is exploring right now in the 21st century. There's at least a dozen very promising ground-based and space-based indicators that the American people should be aware of. This earthquake prediction is impossible. Canard is it's headed for the dustpan of history, and I think this book is going to change the conversation on the West Coast.
How far with this new seismology, if it all works, how far in advance can they tell us about an earthquake?
Wow, that's an excellent question. Like I said, there's the eminent scholars that were gracious enough to clue me in about what they were doing from all over the world, from Italy, from Russia, from China, from Japan. They're looking at everything from high energy particle bursts in the upper atmosphere that are captured by satellites to changes in the conductivity of the electrical conductivity along a fault line to measuring the changes in P wave, S wave velocity changes. I have to be careful to choose my words properly here because at this point, nobody is suggesting that there is any surefire, dead certain earthquake prediction, except for what the USGS has done only recently. We may talk about that later. The earthquake early warning system that is being put into place as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
But and as far as the tides are concerned, I'm not suggesting that this is surefire earthquake prediction. Just that these are higher probability windows that if one is concerned to at least have a modicum of an idea when an earthquake might be more likely to strike, there they are. And I don't dare speak for these eminent scholars in my book. I tiptoed around just even, you know, using their quotes verbatim, as it were. I don't want to speak for them. I get the feeling, though, that well, I'll mention one, Dr. Carlo Duglioni. He is the most famous seismologist in Italy. He's the man who discovered in 2006, screaming headlines all over the world with his thesis also. It was featured in National Geographic. He's the man who discovered that the moon was dragging the entire North American continent westward.
Whoa, what a story. Let's talk more about that, David, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Nabhan is with us. We're talking about his new work, Earthquake Prediction, Dawn of the New Seismology. And David, you were talking about the work of Dr. Doug Leone from Italy. Let's get back into that.
Yeah, well, he was, I found his exact quote. He said, you know, he was talking about not setting off fireworks. And I think that's just him, you know, avoiding the tough, you know, worried about tough questions about false alarms and other thorny questions. Mm-hmm. But the other side of the very, you know, answering your question honestly about how closely people have hit earthquakes recently, the truth is that it is happening. And world-renowned newspapers like the Los Angeles Times publishing stories about, well, for example, the earthquake in 1995 that Carnegie Institution seismologist Paul Silver and Tokyo University Hiroshi Wakita, they within hours, China and Myanmar both evacuated a border district between those two countries just hours before a 7.3 earthquake struck on July 11th in 1995, and it was right where they said it would be, exactly when they said it would be, just missed by hours. Myself, I've been on the air many times, not predicting earthquakes, but giving higher probability times and dates that turned out to be extremely accurately, you know, fortuitously synchronous with things that have the San Diego, the 6.3 San Diego earthquake in 2012.
That's one of the biggest we've had in a while, isn't it?
5 hours off.
Yeah.
The 6.0 Napa Valley quake of just a few months ago, dead on. And I mean, I could go on and on. Over the last 20 years, there's got to have been easily a dozen large earthquakes, 5.0 or more, that were missed by me alone, by minutes or by hours or, you know, by a day. But insofar as what's happening elsewhere, these paradigms are accurate, and the reluctance for the people like Dr. Doug Leone and others to be reticent to speak like I am, you know, they're eminent scientists. They have an, you know, their reputation is sterling, and the scientific method requires that they rein themselves in. But to answer you honestly, people are predicting earthquakes all over the planet right now, and in the near future, we're gonna, I think, find that the paradigm shift is going to be marked.
David, the late geologist Jim Berkland used to come on my show quite often.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about several things that full moons or new moons always seem to have some kind of earthquake. But he also used to look in the newspaper for missing animal reports, mm-hmm. You know, that people would put ads in. I'm missing, you know, my dog's missing. Can you help me find it? Here's a reward, or a cat or something. And he said when he would notice an inordinate high level of missing animals, an earthquake always followed. Amazing. It's not really scientific, but it seemed to work.
Well, I don't know whether it's scientific or not, but you might be interested to note that another Dr. Cristiano Fidani, physicist laureate at the Grand Sasso Laboratories in Italy, another
Italian.
Another,
wow.
Italian, and another great, great physicist who was gracious enough to take the time and trouble to set me straight about a number of things. He's the fellow who is the expert on these high energy particle bursts in the upper atmosphere. But as we were talking, the subject of animal perception came up, and instead of him shying away from it, he set me straight about a number of incidents that he himself wrote about in abstracts that he sent me, having to do with cattle coming up and down in the Italian Alps, strange animal perceptive incidents that he noted and that he cataloged and that he published in the most esteemed European scholarly journal. So don't imagine that what you and Jim Berkland are the State Seismological Bureau in Beijing for the last 50 years has been employing thousands of researchers and observers throughout that country looking at what animals are doing. And I don't think it's harebrained at all, because obviously your common sense would tell you everything the things that animals can do are astounding as it is. To imagine that we know everything that whales communicating across 10,000 kilometers in the ocean. We didn't even know that elephants could do that until that they also communicate with infrasonic communication through their pads. That was just discovered a few years ago. So anybody who thinks that we know everything that there is to know about animal perception, it better think again, because with trillions of tons of bedrock heaving and certainly sending out infrasonic and electromagnetic signals prior to an earthquake, it's not harebrained at all to imagine that certain species should be able to pick that up.
David, in 2004, the Indian Ocean earthquake, which hit and hit big, 280,000 people presumed dead or missing from that catastrophe. But everybody who was able to witness this said that the animals seemed to head for the hills way before the tsunami even hit the shores.
And that has been, National Geographic also has documented that. A quarter of a million human beings killed, and the number of elephants and water buffalo, do you know what the number of killed was? Nobody does.
Probably zero.
It was too few to count. That has, the first time that has been, and that's also very old, George, the great Helike earthquake in Greece, 373 BC, Aelian almost paraphrases exactly, the classical writer Aelian almost word for word what the National Geographic is saying in 2004, that just prior to the event, martens, mice, rats, beetles, snakes of all sort fled the city for higher ground. And throughout history, we've heard the same litany of these animal perceptive prior to earthquake incidents. And just again ignored, like a dozen other precursors, which are not being ignored now.
What do you think these creatures have, David? Some kind of sensing device, or do they pick up vibrations on the ground? What do you think they have?
They do, because the monarch butterflies. You know, there are many species that fly tens of thousands of kilometers back and forth across, and there's no way to know how can the monarch butterflies traverse such astounding distances and make it to the same valley in Mexico year after year after century after millennia. They're zoning in on some sort of electromagnetic or magnetic or infrasonic. Sharks. Sharks can detect blood from a kilometer away in the open ocean. Their skin has sensors to pick up the electrical twitches in muscles of their prey. And again, back to what I just said. Imagine, people don't realize the amount of energy that is expended in a giant earthquake. It is absolutely astounding. It's astronomical. The amount of joules that are expended are equal to picking up one of Saturn's moons. In my book, I make a comparison between the Great Chile earthquake and what it would do to the same amount of energy to pick up one of Saturn's moons and use it to twirl around like a baton. Same amount of joules. You can't have trillions of tons of bedrock heaving like that without some sort of again, infrasonic, electromagnetic. Dr. Freund in my book, the greatest of them all, I think he's my favorite, Dr. Friedman Freund, he looks at the San Andreas as kind of like a transistor, an 800-mile-long transistor that as you compress it with piezoelectric effects and the other effects that very arcane physics. I don't want to lose your audience, but that you can squeeze electromagnetic signals out of these fault lines, and that they might be picked up by by a certain species of animals.
And David, what about fracking? We hear so much about fracking these days.
Well, yes, no kidding. Here's an instance that really demonstrates exactly what I what people, you know, you have. It's hard to get the truth sometimes as when people, you know, move away from the scientific method. I was one of the first individuals on the planet to publicly declare that fracking and earthquakes were connected in an op-ed in the third largest newspaper in Missouri in 2012. So it seems to me that there is certainly a link there. I mean, pumping water under pressure into the bedrock of a seismically active zone is like pulling on the tail of a lion. You're asking for an earthquake. But and we've known this for decades, not just with fracking. If you want to force water under pressure into fissures, you don't need to just do it with fracking. You could build a dam. And we've known that dams also, there's hardly been a great dam ever constructed that wasn't whose opening wasn't punctuated with seismic fireworks. Hoover Dam, the Vajont Dam in Italy, the Kremasta in Greece. The most striking evidence, the 80,000 people who were killed in 2008 in China at the Xipingpu Dam, it had just been completed, and that giant earthquake took place, the epicenter, 500 meters from the dam. Geophysicist Christian Close and other scientists in the STEAM journal Science made it very clear that they themselves had no doubt that the dam caused the earthquake. So the other side of the coin, though, is if we have to be kind of careful about issuing any clarion calls to ban fracking, because down that road, you know, we would be asking to, you know, there's a number of things that go along with it, like dismantling our dams. And even worse, the greatest natural disaster in Australian history, the 1989 Newcastle earthquake, was precipitated by human engineering expertise as well. Coal mining near Boolooroo in New South Wales. So that was the epicenter of that earthquake. So going down this road, you know, no dams, no mines, no electricity, no fuels, no raw materials, it leads nowhere. But it doesn't hurt to, you know, to be honest about this, and that's what I try to do. The scientific method, you're not supposed to only give out the information that buoys up your side of a political debate. So I like gasoline in my car. I like, I like talking to you on this phone, and, you know, the electricity is provided by hydrocarbon fuels.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't change the fact that it's incumbent upon me to answer honestly. Yeah, fracking and earthquakes, they're definitely connected.
I want you to talk about this astounding proposal that you talk about in your book about putting forward here in California.
Well, I mentioned Dr. Freund. Dr. Friedman Freund is the, let me tell you who he is. He's the principal investigator at NASA for 25 years, lead scientist at the SETI Institute, professor of physics at San Jose State University. He's got quite a few pages in my book, and Dr. Freund has spent over $1 million of his own personal funds in order to nudge NASA in the direction of placing a series of dishwasher-sized satellites in orbit that he believes could serve as the beginnings of a rudimentary warning system. I'm following Dr. Freund's lead, and I'm making a public offer in my book, and I'm pleased to say it in front of your 3 million listeners, to the California Earthquake Prediction Evaluation Council, that it should be convened to pass judgment on the very simple precepts I've outlined in my book, and I'll be more than happy to pay for it if it's a matter of money that is holding them back to pass judgment on this very simple piece of empirical evidence that I am asking be examined by the authorities. I'm doing the opposite. I'm going to press them to do so. If I have to, I don't know what kind of shape California is in as far as their exchequer is concerned, but if I have to shame California into doing it by challenging them to pay for it myself, that's the way we'll have to go if it's going to prod them into action. Fair-minded people listening to this should have no trouble judging how serious I'm about, you know, how determined I am to get a fair hearing for this. I talked to you about this 6 years ago, and I've been talking about it on the air for the last 20 years. CBS News, Popular Science, many very highly respected venues just like yours. So let the people of California see that and determine if the appropriate response of their government is to continue ignoring me. And as I said, in a nutshell, then, I want my day in court. Everything I put in my book is very simple. It could be puzzled out by those great scholars in a week, in a weekend, and I'm willing to pay for it. So, Governor Brown, your aides have my email address. If they've lost it, anyone can access it at www.earthquakepredictors.com. I get email there from all over the world. I hope the honorable governor drops me a line.
David, are the cities prepared for a major earthquake of a 7+?
You know, that's I hate to be the naysayer, and I'm going to say some good stuff now. Los Angeles is probably one of the best prepared cities on earth to take a monster a blow from a giant earthquake.
Wow,
San Francisco as well. The state and cities and the communities and the citizens of California, the schools, the retrofitting, the building codes. California has done a superlative job. I have to really give credit where it's due. Los Angeles is well prepared to take a giant blow and remain standing. However, with all the preparation that's being done, and that's, you know, that's been California's mantra, you know, preparation, and it's certainly a smart thing to do. 99% of the effort, though, has been in preparation, and the poor sister has been prediction. And the point that I've been trying to make is, you know, preparation is fantastic, but the greatest weapon that any enemy has is that of surprise. And allowing the San Andreas to just, you know, it's not 1857. The last big one was 1857, and when it struck at Fort Tejon, these 7.8, 8.0 earthquakes, these big ones, people should realize it shook Los Angeles for a full 3 minutes.
Oh, that is a long time in an earthquake. David, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Earthquake Prediction, and we're going to take phone calls. If you've also ever been in an earthquake, share that story.